I will edit this out. This is the editing out song. We have 5 new countries that have left reviews for us in iTunes. And this week it is Belarus, China, Malta, Slovenia, and Uruguay. So again, it's awesome to collect more countries. We really have quite a full roster now of places that have left iTunes reviews. So I just want to say thanks to everyone, and thanks to everyone from those countries who left a review.
We only just got China.
I was surprised that we only just got China. And I was almost wondering if the iTunes store was even available in China. I wasn't sure if it was like YouTube, which I don't know if the internet is aware or not, but YouTube is not available in China. So I was wondering if maybe the iTunes store wasn't available in China. But so we now do have the most populous nation on earth added to our collection of countries.
No, we're breaking into big markets now, mate.
Yes, yes.
It's going to take off. It's going to take off.
We're going to capture all of that China market very shortly.
We might have to start doing a China version of the podcast where we do the whole thing again, speaking in Mandarin or something.
Yes, yes. That will never happen.
Okay. But okay. So the last podcast was about emailing.
Yes.
And you gave some advice about emailing that I personally found really useful, and I know some of the viewers did. Mm-hmm. And I sort of, you went up in my estimations as an emailer.
Oh, thank you.
And then last night...
Oh, no.
You sent me, like, I guess maybe for a normal person it would be an okay email, but some crazy email, like, very long for you, a bit rambling. You even apologized for it in the email.
I can't believe you're bringing this up.
Had you been drinking or something?
No, I was just very tired. I was very tired, and you were last on my email queue, and I thought I was being much more rational than I was. But yes, I did send you a rather rambly email that did not make a whole lot of sense when I saw it in the morning, and I was slightly embarrassed. And yes, that was perfectly timed to come after the show about sending efficient emails. So
I should start some sort of Kickstarter or crowd campaign, and if people give enough money, I'll like share the email with the world.
No, I don't think that's necessary. I don't think we need to do that.
All right,
we can skip that one.
What else is going on then? Was there much else in the feedback? I've been following the Reddit. It's been good fun.
Yes, yes, I have. I've been following the Reddit as well, and I think we both commented. I'll put it in the show notes. Someone left an absolutely hilarious image that I want to find out. Whoever left this image, I need to know where this is from. But this hilarious image under just the link said, CGP Grey visits Brady in his house. And when you click the link, it goes to this comical picture of this robot standing in a caveman's dwelling.
I'm looking at it now. It's perfect.
It is absolutely perfect.
I know talking about a photo is not excellent podcast fodder, but I do recommend people go and have a look. People always say, oh, what does CGP Grey look like? Funnily enough, for some strange reason, this does look like you. Like that robot is somehow captures you. I don't know how.
I think people want to know. I think
go and have a look.
Yeah, that's why it's funny, is I can look at that robot too and feel like I am kin to this creature.
Yeah.
we're on the same level there. So whoever
and it does help that the caveman as well has kind of long matted ginger hair. So that sort of adds to the braidiness of him as well. So
yes, yes.
I don't have quite such impressive biceps, unfortunately.
But yeah, so I'll put a link in the show notes. People can check that out. And if someone can tell us, or the original poster can tell us, where that's from, I'm really curious. It looks like it's from some TV show in the 60s, maybe. I don't know exactly, but I'd be really curious to know the origins of that image.
Underine is the person who posted it. So hopefully they're listening.
Yes, thanks to him or her. That was hilarious and really made me laugh.
Yeah, I've got it on my screen today, so I'm looking at it throughout the podcast.
Good.
Into those gray-like eyes.
What else from follow-up? I don't know if I should mention this now, but you did ask a question which I never really got around to answering in the previous one. But you asked me some examples of terrible emails that I get.
Yeah, worst practice.
Yeah, worst practices. And I just when I was going through my email the other day, I just made a note of some of the emails that I do get. So just very quickly, some of my least favorite things to get are the sort of emails that people write where apparently random words in the sentence are cap locks. They're written in all caps. And it's like these people want to use italics, but instead they just use all caps. And so you read it as though they're sort of shouting every fifth or sixth word. I get enough of those usually from people who are very angry about something that I've mentioned in a video that they think is right or wrong. So that's an example of crazy.
Okay.
An example of a professional one that irritates the heck out of me is sending emails to schedule phone calls or meetings without actually telling me anything at all about what we were going to have a phone call or a meeting about. That's a very bad practice.
Yeah.
And I would just say the ones that I get the most often, which I do delete them just straight away, but I almost feel like it was good try, kid, is kids in school basically asking me to write essays for them on a particular topic. Which happens often enough. Some kid will literally send me like a scanned image of his homework assignment and say, you know, oh, I need to write a 300-word essay on this particular topic. Would you mind, you know, doing that for me? It's like, obviously I'm not going to do that, but you know what? Almost like props to you for asking, but delete immediately.
It takes you 6 weeks to write a YouTube script. How long is it going to take you to write a school essay?
Yeah, but see, the thing is, with a school essay, if I did write it, I would have no incentive to do it well at all. You know, so that's, you know, no, I'm not the one who's going to get the D. Wouldn't be my fault.
A whole category of emails that I get because of making mathematics videos are people, or science videos in general, really, are people who have theories. People who have think they've discovered perpetual motion or, you know, a new form of nuclear energy. And it's sort of
cold
a spike. I get a lot of them. But that has spiked this week that I made a video about the Riemann hypothesis, which is the sort of the greatest unsolved puzzle now in mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And inevitably I've started getting emails now from people who think they've possibly cracked it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, of course, I'm in no position to know if they've cracked it or not. It puts me in a difficult position. Do I delete? Do
yes,
I forward to
answer.
A mathematician
no.
and therefore become
no, you do not.
Become the crazy person myself now who's forwarding on?
No, this is
theories.
Not a difficult position at all. Delete is the correct answer. Right? This is not something to ponder or feel anxiety over.
Yeah, but imagine
delete.
If G.H. Hardy had got his letter from Ramanujan and just said delete. You know, sometimes you've got to have a look and see if there's any gold in there.
No, you do not. Not when people are sending you math proofs through your email to you, who they should know is not actually, you know, the professor who can necessarily verify this thing. Although actually, I don't know if you've come across this. I was just reading, an interesting book called Average is Over by Tyler Cowen, I think is the author's name. But in it, he mentions this thing about how with a lot of modern math proofs for something like the Riemann conjecture, that there basically isn't even any individual human who can know if this is true or not anymore. That for these big math proofs, what the math community does is that they break it down into the smallest pieces they can and farm that off to a whole bunch of experts in those individual areas who then everyone has to come back with a consensus about whether or not their part is correct and kind of come to a community decision about whether all these pieces fit together to prove the thing as a whole. I don't know if you've come across that, but I found that interesting just to think about. Like, boy, you know, it's not like you can someone can even just send in a proof and one person can necessarily really work it out on their own.
I mean, even something like the Poincaré, I can never say it correctly, Poincaré conjecture.
Mm-hmm.
You know the one.
Yeah.
It was one of the, it's the only one of the seven millennium problems that has been solved.
Mm-hmm.
And even that was sort of just, it was solved by attrition in many ways. I mean, they solved it for all the different dimensions and then eventually the only dimension they couldn't solve it for was the third dimension. So that became the Holy Grail. And this guy called Hamilton came up with you know, a way to do it using Ricci flow. But then finally Perlman, who ended up, you know, getting all the glory, came up with this this surgery technique that he applied to the Ricci flow that made it solvable. So, you know, even when it's not a big team doing it, it's usually one person building on all these other things. And one of the reasons Perlman gave for rejecting the Millennium Prize was he felt like you shouldn't be giving this prize to one person. You know, I couldn't have done it without Hamilton's work, and I'm not totally convinced, and some of the mathematicians I speak to aren't totally convinced that's the only reason he rejected the $1 million, but it's certainly a reason he gave.
I think that one was actually mentioned in the book that I was just reading, as an example of a proof that had to be farmed out to a whole bunch of people to try to figure out, you know, is this even correct? Let's see. The only other thing I might just mention here is that a lot of people commented on how serious I got at the end of the last podcast.
I noticed that.
I can't.
This was when I was talking about my my addiction to checking my email.
Yes. Yeah. That's what you were talking about. And I guess I can't hear it in my own voice, but enough people commented on Reddit that they notice the swing in my tone to suddenly very serious tone.
No, it's true.
And yes, it is true. I just wanted to make a little comment about that, about why I'm so serious about this. Why I'm so serious about internet addiction, email addiction, Twitter addiction.
Even now you sound a little bit more serious.
As I'm trying not to be. I don't want this to be an after-school special. You know, listen, kids. You know, we all had fun today, but email is serious.
Brady, I've brought a few of your friends along here to talk on the podcast as well. We all want to speak to you about this problem.
Yeah, I guess. Okay. No, okay. I'm going to try to say this without sounding really serious.
Okay.
But the reason that I do take that stuff very seriously, and I notice it, just like what the nature of addiction is, like these kind of sort of psychological addictions that you have to things like email. You know, I'm not talking like a physical addiction, like a drug. And if you are doing an experiment on a human and you want to encourage them to continue in a behavior, the best and most effective way to do that is with something called random reinforcement. You know, so if you want someone or some lab animal, you know, to press a button, the best way to make sure they press that button as often as possible is to not give them a consistent reward. You know, don't give them a food pellet each time, but give them a random reward. Sometimes they get nothing. Sometimes they get a whole bunch of food pellets. You know, sometimes they get very few food pellets, but there's a random distribution in the reward. And basically for all mammals, that is maximally addictive. And this is why things like slot machines can be very addictive for people, right? Because they are random reinforcement. You know, if you put like a quarter in a slot machine and every time you got back 20 cents, nobody would play them. Right, because it'd be very obvious what's happening. But if you vary the reward, that mammalian brains are just designed to really hook into that kind of behavior, and so that's basically what Twitter and even Reddit and email can be really addictive in that way, because they're this random reinforcement. Right, sometimes you go to your email and it's something really important that you need to know, or something really interesting on Reddit, and lots of times it's just kind of nothing, but your brain is always hoping for a big payoff. And that's why we mentioned last time, somebody's like, oh, I don't remember opening Twitter, but Twitter's open, like clearly I did it. All right, that's exactly what that is. Like that is a sign that your brain is engaged in this random reward response and is really looking for that. So that's why I got super serious. And I will leave it now. I will try not to talk about that anymore.
You're making me feel really good here with all this talk about mammalian brains and behaviors and addictions and you realize I'm kind of part of this conversation, don't you?
Well, but I am part of this conversation too, right? This is why I'm always sad that I'm not a robot. I'm not that robot in that image before, because I'm keenly aware of the sad limitations of my own mammal monkey brain, right? I think I'm this clever, rational person, right? But I have a monkey brain in my skull just like every other human does. And that monkey brain is easily distracted and it doesn't want to pay attention, or it engages in all this horrible self-destructive behavior. So this is like being productive is learning to deal with the monkey in your head who just wants to sit in the sunshine and eat bananas, you know, or go run around and do other kinds of stuff. So that's that. Enough with the seriousness. Just mention a quick link. This is going back a couple shows ago, but on one of my favorite sections of Reddit is a section called Change My View, which is a, it's not exactly a formal debate, but they have more rules than most sections on Reddit do. And people put forward an argument and then people try to change their view on whatever this topic is. And there was an interesting discussion a little while ago that related to our episode about advertising and ad blocking. I'll put it in the show notes, but the Change My View, the debate topic was, you know, if using an ad block is stealing content, stealing, I know you like that, then so is going to the bathroom during a commercial break. Change my view. So the person is arguing that that ad blocking on the internet is the equivalent of simply not watching ads on TV. And it's as with many of the discussions on that subreddit, it's a very interesting discussion back and forth between a whole bunch of people. So I found it interesting to read through, and I will put that in the show notes as something related to our episode. I don't even know, episode 4 or 5? I can't keep track of them now. This is 7, right? I think we're on 7.
Oh, yeah. This is our last prime number of the experiment then.
It is our last prime number of the experiment. Good on you for thinking that.
Thank you. Was the was this debate cross-posted to the newly created freebooting subreddit, which I noted the other day?
Yes, I saw someone. I saw someone made that. I took a little screenshot because I thought, now you are the one who's pushing this freebooting word again. Again, internet, I'm totally fine with copyright infringement. Though I will admit
you're
that
fine
awkward.
With copyright infringement. The term, I hope, not the practice.
Yes, the term. Although I will acknowledge that it is very awkward in certain circumstances. But I noticed on the description of the freebooting subreddit, the description is that this is a subreddit that is about those who don't want to pay, or sorry, about those who don't pay for content, and I think, if I'm understanding your use of the term freebooting, that that this is not to be confused with piracy, that freebooting is to be applied to the people who are making money off of content creators' materials. It's not talking about the people who may be viewing that content elsewhere or just torrenting it or something else. Is that correct?
I think you grossly overestimate the amount of thought I've put into the term freebooting.
Ah, you disappoint me, Brady.
But I'll go with whatever you said. I just think it's a cool word, and I think infringement is like... My position is clear on this, as is yours.
Okay, all right. Yeah. But yeah, someone made the freebooting subreddit, I think. I haven't gone over to look to see how much discussion is over there, but I'll put it in the show notes.
Oh, man, if this word catches on in any way... Like, I'll be so proud. Like, that original podcast where I brought it up will become like a historic document.
It will. That will be in the Oxford English Dictionary when they talk about first usage of a term. It'll
Oh yeah.
Right? Because that's what they need to have, like earliest known use of this word. It'll be Brady in a podcast. I like that. Hello, Internet. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. Squarespace has been around for 10 years, and they're constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. They have beautiful designs for you to start with, and they have a ton of style options so you can create unique websites for you or your business. They released 20 new customizable templates this past year alone, and every design automatically includes a mobile experience that matches your overall style. And every design automatically includes a mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website so your content looks great on every device, every time. And speaking of mobile, the new Squarespace Metric app for iPhone and iPad allows you to check site stats like page views, unique visitors, and social media followers. And with the blog app, you can make text updates, drag and drop images, and changes to layout and monitor comments on the go. And again, speaking personally, I just have to say that Squarespace support is absolutely amazing. They're what I use to host this podcast, and when I was setting it up, I did have a bunch of questions for how to do this, or what setting is best for that, or how to get this part of the site tweaked in a particular way that I wanted, and the support team was just amazing, always with incredibly rapid turnaround at any time of the day, any day of the week. So they have quite a crew over there that are really working hard to make sure that all of your questions are answered.
So Squarespace is good for everyone. Whether you need a simple website solution or you are a developer and want to get into the code, there are so many options, and it starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So start a trial today with no credit card required and begin to build your website. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code HELLOINTERNET, all one word, to get 10% off and show your support for this show. Or you can click the link in the description below to use the offer code to sign up and again get 10% off. So we want to thank everyone at Squarespace for their support. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Pi Day?
It is Pi Day today, the day we're recording.
It is the 14th of March, or March 14, so we get this 314 for Pi.
Right.
So we are using the American month there, but because there is no sort of third of the 14th month, I think even Brits and Europeans are quite happy to go with this one.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it's become one of these internet holidays. I've been seeing everybody on the Twitter talking about it today.
Yeah. So obviously having a YouTube channel all about numbers, I have a tremendous interest in Pi. I think I've made about 15 videos about Pi.
Really?
There's a whole playlist of them.
It sounds like you need a channel dedicated to Pi at this point, if you have 15 videos.
Maybe. We'll stick with the one for now. But so I put a couple of videos up today for this year's Pi Day, but I don't want to talk about them. Mm. I want to talk about Vi-Hart's video for Pi Day. For those who don't know Vi-Hart, you should.
Yes.
She's certainly a favorite of both of us.
Yes.
And a good friend. And her video for Pi Day today, like all her videos, was excellent. I mean, in a nutshell, I mean, I hope people will watch it if they haven't already seen it, and I'm sure Gray will pop it in the show notes.
Yeah, of course.
But in a nutshell, she was saying that Pi is no big deal. It's an ordinary number, like every single other number on the number line. Mm-hmm. And I guess some of the points she made were really good and educational about, you know, their infinite number of numbers with repeating digits and things like that. But the tone of the video was Pi is no big deal. What's the big deal with Pi Day? Pi is a nothing number. Mm-hmm. And she sort of, was attacking or chipping away at a lot of the things people love about Pi.
Mm-hmm.
And fair enough. And like I said, I enjoyed it very much. But I do think that Pi is allowed to be special and exceptional. And whether or not we celebrate Pi Days, you know, that's just a silly thing, isn't it? But I think it is okay to celebrate Pi and to love Pi. And I love Pi. Now, I've been thinking about why that is.
Uh-huh.
And some of this maybe comes back to what you were talking about with kind of this random reinforcement. But I think maybe the ordinariness and the complete and utter arbitrariness of Pi is why we love it. That a number that seems so just weirdly out of nowhere, just like a strange number that has nothing special about it to look at it, could become such a celebrity and could become so imbued with meaning to us as humans is what we like about it. Like it's almost like a product of its own sort of celebrity. It's a bit like, it's like the number that won the lottery. It won the lottery. Like, because we chose to put some significance into the ratio of a circle's diameter to its circumference. Mm-hmm. Because I can see why we did that, because the circle is a pretty special shape, but it is just another shape. But because that particular ratio we decided to celebrate, so then we had to go and find the poor old number on the number line that happened to represent that ratio. And this one number was just plucked from obscurity and we put on a pedestal and said, good on you, number. You have some significance to us because you somehow relate to the wheel. I think that is like, I think that appeals to us as humans. Like the way we are appealed to the lucky person who lands the half-court shot at the basketball game, or the person who has the $100 million winning lottery ticket. I mean, there's nothing special about that person. They just were in the right place at the right time. They were plucked from obscurity amongst all the other humans. And I think that, like, gives us, like, some kind of No, I think it appeals to us. I know a robot like you is not going to understand that.
I find your anthropomorphization of pie just ludicrous.
Really? I think it's a very human thing to do. Like, you know, like how some people have a soft spot for Saturn because it's got rings, or, you know, we look for little...
But that is different. Like I just think your description of like, oh, there's all these poor numbers milling around, and like, we as a society have taken this one number and raised him up to celebrity status, and he was the lucky guy in the right place at the right time. I don't know. I find that whole description very hard to relate to, and very, yeah, very funny to...
Well, I don't know. What do you think? Do you subscribe to, you know, what's the big deal with pi? It's you know, it's a number of, you know.
Well, first of all, I just to mention about Vi's video. If you haven't watched it, go watch it now and then come back. The link is in the show notes, because there will be mild spoilers for the video.
Okay.
But the thing that I liked about the video was... Basically, Vi was going through all of the things that are normally said about the uniqueness of pi and pointing out how they are not unique. And she was doing it with very typical Vi humor. Like, she really got me to laugh out loud a couple times in the video.
Yeah, but, you know, it was really good.
Yeah, like when she pointed out that, you know, oh, people talk about how it has an infinite number of digits. You know, well, 5 has an infinite number of digits. It just so happens to be that all those digits are 0, right? But so the infiniteness of these numbers is not special. And something that I hadn't ever really thought about, but talking about irrational numbers, that there's an infinite number of irrational numbers, it's not like there's just a couple of special ones and pi and e happen to be those special numbers, which is something I never really thought about in that exact way, which is why I like Vi's videos. She's always pointing out these things. Yeah. So she was just taking apart all of the unique elements of pi, and I think doing it in a very good way. I really liked it.
Yeah. And I had a lot. Yeah, it was thought provoking for that reason.
Yeah, it was good.
But I still think it's okay to love pi and think it's special.
Okay, so now before I tell you my opinions on this, I will first say that back in high school, when I was doing driver's ed and I was very, very bored, I actually spent a bunch of time memorizing the digits of pi, you know, because I was a nerdy person. Now, wow. I'm not like one of these Olympiads who memorizes tens of thousands of digits. But I had somewhere around the first 200 digits memorized,
wow,
and I could
that
write
is
them
impressive.
Out. Well,
that
it's,
is impressive.
It sounds impressive. It is not as impressive as it actually sounds, because I was using, you know, there's memory techniques for this kinds of things where you can transform digits into words and then the words into sentences. And so it's not as hard as it actually sounds to memorize an arbitrary sequence of digits. You know, this is basically a technique that I learned for school and to memorize stuff. And so then I was just, you know, just doing this as a boredom kind of thing. And I thought pi was cool, right? Because I was a nerdy high school guy. And I never came across tau until some point when I was in college. I don't remember exactly when, but some math professor brought it up.
This is 2 pi. This is twice pi.
Yeah,
some
yeah.
Some people argue is a more obvious constant to use.
Yeah, so basically I think the to sum it up, is that pi is based on the diameter of the circle, mm-hmm, and tau is based on the radius of the circle.
Yes.
And the argument is usually that you're talking about most shapes, you talk about their most fundamental part. And for a circle, its most fundamental part is the radius, not the diameter. And so pi is a little weird that it's using this non-fundamental part of the shape to define it. So my opinion on the whole pi versus tau debate is one of utility. And when I heard about tau, honest to God, so much of trigonometry really clicked in my mind. And I thought, oh, I know this is just a conversion of a factor of 2, but boy, did it suddenly, trigonometry made a whole lot more sense in my mind with the pi, sorry, switching from pi to tau. And so that's why I have read things from other mathematicians saying that again, this is like way out of my league, but that tau is only really useful in this kind of high school, college level math, and that when you get beyond this level, you know, maybe there are arguments in favor of pi. I don't really know those arguments. Yeah. But I would just say for the level of math that I was doing, tau made things just instantly so much simpler. And, you know, being able to understand like the sine function, you know, talking about every kid who's in high school is listening to me now, right? You have to do, you know, you have to memorize these things. You know, what is the sine of pi over 2? What is the sine of pi over 4? And you need to have these things off the top of your head. And it just, it seems like it's completely arbitrary. But if you use tau instead, it's always just a fraction of the direction around a circle. So if someone asks you, you know, what's the sine of tau over 4? You just have to think, oh, okay, well, I go a fourth of the way around the circle. And if you imagine that on a number line, it's very obviously 1. I hope I'm doing this right in my head. and so, you know, tau over 2, you go halfway around the circle. And, you know, what's the height? It's 0. So I am in favor of tau because it just, to me, made so much of trigonometry make immediate sense, where the pi stuff, I had always had a hard time with pi and radians and never quite gotten it. So,
well, there are some good videos on it. There are some good number file videos on it. You'd probably enjoy the Phil Moriarty one about tau, because he's pro tau and talks about some of those things you were just talking about. But even if you use tau, it's still just, you know, it's still an arbitrary constant. Where do you stand on this idea of us celebrating an arbitrary number and, you know, having these celebrity numbers?
Well, I think celebrity numbers. I know what you mean. I still think it's a funny term. I mean, I would say I am for it. You know, for example, I love the fact that there is a pi day. I'm not going to get all grumpy because I think tau is a better number and then we're having a pi day, because this whole day allows this discussion to happen and you can talk about math and it brings math up as a topic. So I'm very much in favor of that.
Of and having it's Einstein's birthday, of course.
Oh, is it? I did not know that.
I believe so.
So yeah, I'm in favor of celebrity numbers. I can't conceive of a reason not to be. And if, you know, if people really like pi, I think maybe part of the celebrity of pi is that it is an interesting looking number, right? Whereas tau looks too much like a T, and the imaginary number is an I.
It's a cool symbol. It's a cool symbol.
Yeah, it's a very cool symbol. Or if people who've been following me on Twitter know that I have been reworking my way through The Wire, the TV series, for probably the fourth or fifth time now.
Man, that's a good show.
Yeah. Oh, man, I could talk about that forever. And there is a character in the second season who has a pi tattoo on the back of his neck. And I always wonder if this is I assume that maybe it's the actor's tattoo. I was always kind of curious about that, because it's a detail that is striking in the second season and seems a little bit out of place. But yeah, the pi symbol is just cool. So I can see why it is more prominent as a feature. Or it looks cool on movie posters. You know, if you want to have something mathy, you put the pi up there. It's immediately recognizable. Whereas lots of other math symbols, they're just using boring old regular letters, you know, and that's not as interesting. But yeah, so I guess I'm in favor of
celebrity
numbers.
Well, I'm sorry
numbers.
For humanizing numbers like that. I am rather sleep deprived, and maybe my brain is addled, but I'm a bit more like that. I quite like the idea.
No,
I don't know.
I'm in favor of the celebrity numbers. I think the level of your description just struck me as very funny.
I mean, it's an analogy, isn't it? You get that, of course. I think they're humans, but I think people like, you know, it just appeals to our love.
People
of,
like the underdog, is that what you're
that's
saying?
That's exactly what I was about to say. It's an underdog. Who would have thought that some little obscure, irrational number just sitting a little way after 3 could have become the hero of numbers? And yet he did. He did. He sat there thinking, oh, well, I'm never going to amount to anything. And then one day he became the symbol that even CGP Grey talks about on his podcast.
You should write a book.
I think I've been beaten to it.
You should write a children's book about that.
Maybe I should make 15 videos about it instead.
Yeah, right.
What's going on with you? I think we have, even for a celebrity number, we have given pi its dues today.
Yeah, I think so. Right, so I want to guys complain about something for a minute here. I want to complain about is the West Coast time zone. I know last week I said East Coast is the best coast, which, again, a lot of feedback on that one. Yeah. But you are in the West Coast.
I am.
And I am in London right now. Mm. And I have got to say that the West Coast has the world's most inconvenient time zone ever. I cannot stand the West Coast time zone.
I'm with you. I'm with you there.
Oh, so I'm so glad about this. I remember at the last YouTube EDU conference, I was getting into arguments with people over this, right? We just thought I was some kind of lunatic. And of course, it doesn't help you to argue with the locals about the craziness of their own time zone. But it drives me nuts. And as you can see, for the last couple of days, you know, even us just trying to schedule this thing, the California late waking up, it just kills scheduling meetings. Yeah. It's so inconvenient.
So many. Like I mean, half the reason I'm delirious and making stupid arguments about Pi is because I had to stay up all night because I wanted to put my videos up and respond to them mm-hmm. at a time that was good for people in Europe and mm-hmm. And on the East Coast. And also, the number of time I often hear people having phone calls and they're saying, okay, well, so everyone's finished work now, so maybe we'll put some calls into them tomorrow. And mm-hmm. this is like, you know, the middle of the day for people here.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I have to say that the time that this really killed me the most, and again, I will have to be a bit vague here, but when I was having those problems with the Subbable launch during the summer, mm-hmm. I would say some reasonable portion of the amount of time it took to get those problems sorted was due to the time difference between the East Coast and the West Coast of the United States. And I was on the East Coast at that time. I happened to be in America. And of course, because I'm on the East Coast, since I'm the one who wakes up first, it feels like, okay, you're looking at your clock and just waiting for California to wake up, you know, yeah. so they can get the 10 voicemails or emails that you've sent. And then, you know, it's like you only have this narrow window of time when even the East Coast and the West Coast are kind of aligned for business deals, you know, or business dealings. And then, you know, God help you if you're in London trying to schedule something with someone on the West Coast. And so West Coast time zone, I do not approve. I think it's really inconvenient. And I always feel this, it's like this weird out of timeness when I'm there, you know, on the West Coast of even just things like Twitter, you know, if I, you know, it's evening mm. time and that's my more likely to be on Twitter messing around. And I realize, yeah. oh, I'm not getting any replies because the rest of the world is asleep.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
You know, it's absolutely bizarre. So I think West Coast, you need to do something about that.
Of course, this is unsolvable. You realize it's because of the position on the Earth and the sun, of course.
Well, actually, I'll see if I can find it for the show notes. But I read a really good article where someone had a proposal that was not too crazy for how to at least change the U.S. into two time zones. So that you basically would have a time zone running down the middle of the United States, and so that they would only be off by an hour. And this was also combined with one of my favorite things, which is getting rid of daylight savings time. And so you could do a switch during one of the daylight savings times and just hold everything steady with two giant time zones in the United States. So at least it would only be 1 hour off. And I was like, ooh, I really like this plan. What can we do to get this sorted? I approve of this.
But don't a whole bunch of people, like, then everyone's got to compromise, though, don't they? And some people are going to have to work in the dark or, you know, like that's not going to change where the sun is.
No, I understand.
Vast, vast country, so.
I understand, like, it's not going to change where the sun is.
So,
but.
And you,
But as I read through it, it was reasonable with sunrise and sunset times. And then I think on top of that, if you just stop with the daylight savings nonsense of moving around the hours all the time, people will just adjust, right? People will get used to it, right? It's like I moved here to London and I remember the first winter I was here, I literally just freaked out the first time the sun set all of a sudden at 4 o'clock after the daylight savings time change. I remember yeah. sitting in a classroom and looking outside and it was pitch black and it's 4:30.
Thought it was an eclipse or something, did you?
I honestly just did not know what was going on because I have not lived this far north. And yeah. Now I will say it has taken me a good 8 years to get used to the winters in London and how early the sun sets, but you get yeah. used to it eventually. And so I think if in America, if they adapted to two time zones, people would get used to it and then everyone would be happier. And by everyone, I mean mainly me. And that is that is what I'm looking for there. So
I don't know if you're going to... We'll have to do daylight savings another day because, I mean, I can understand the arguments that you will make, but I have such a nostalgic attachment to daylight savings, like, because it just reminds me of the excitement of getting to stay up later and play cricket with my mates and things like that. I did have a funny experience the other night, though. I was... Because it just changed here in the... on the West Coast, and I didn't know it was happening.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It was just daylight savings time in America, and it's going to be, they're going to do the changeover at the end of the month here in London.
Yeah, I was up in, and I'm capable of wasting vast amounts of time on Reddit and Wikipedia, and I was up in the middle of the night reading Wikipedia articles, mm-hmm. and I didn't know the change was happening or it happened, but mm-hmm. my computer did.
Yes.
And I didn't notice the change. And I sort of looked at the time and then I read another Wikipedia article and then I looked up at the time and I was like, oh my God, where's the time gone? You know, I'm capable of wasting time, but really? Did I just spend an hour reading about that one incident?
Right, because this is spring forward, right?
And it was like 2 days later that I found out it had happened and I was kind of relieved that, you know, I hadn't made some...
I'm going to make a note on our little notes file here where I'm always terrified of running out of things to talk about. But yeah, let's talk about daylight savings time at some point in the future. But I would just...
While you're there, I've got two other things you can add to that list then.
Yeah.
Fahrenheit and Celsius and maybe just metric, you know. I know we've discussed this before amongst us YouTubers, but, you know, that's got to be done sometime.
We can talk about that at some time. I would just, as a final little... time zone thing. I will just put in that while I do think, you know, East Coast is the best coast, I love the East Coast of the United States. London clearly has the best time zone in the whole world. I love London's time zone. It is the most convenient time zone ever.
Not that you're London centric or anything, calling it the London time zone.
Yeah, no, it is. That's all I care about, right? It's the London time zone, right? Greenwich is here. I don't know what else anyone needs to know. I love it. You know, yeah, sort of. You have the whole morning to get stuff done, and then you can shoot stuff off to, you know, shoot emails and phone calls off to people in America. And then they have the whole working day, you know, to deal with whatever you sent them. And I just love the London time zone. It's just the best. It is the absolute best.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, it's very cool. I enjoy the same time zone, even though I don't live in London. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy it also. Sorry for borrowing your time zone, Mr. London, but yeah. So one other thing I was going to bring up was the Malaysia Airlines plane crash, mm-hmm. which has been in the news. Mm-hmm. Is this something you follow or?
So this is something that, we can talk about in a future topic. I make a very conscious effort to not follow the news. And so I know kind of literally nothing about this except that there was... Last time I even saw some headline, it was a lost plane.
It's actually, as we speak now, it still is a lost plane. They haven't, I say plane crash, but they haven't found the plane.
So it is a presumed plane crash?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have to tell me about this then.
Well, I mean, for that very reason that it hasn't been found and no one still knows what happened, certainly while we record this, mm-hmm. I wasn't going to talk about that specifically. But I thought I would talk about plane crashes in general just because, you know, this podcast is about talking about our interests. Mm-hmm. And plane crashes actually are an interest of mine. And I guess we've done six podcasts that people think seem to make you look crazy from time to time. And we seem to be going down. This time it's my turn, having done pie, and now we'll talk about my interest in plane crashes. I'd love to start by saying very quickly how serious I think plane crashes are. And this Malaysia Airlines missing plane is like a serious issue, and mm-hmm. there are, you know, 200 odd people on that plane, mm-hmm. with families and friends, and I would never and will not sort of belittle or diminish what they're going through, and mm-hmm. I hope you know I never have to go through something as catastrophic as that, mm-hmm. but I do have a very great interest in plane crashes, and I always have. It's kind of, you know how we all have these sort of topics that we read voraciously on? Mm-hmm. And for me, plane crashes is certainly one of them. I read NTSB plane crash reports.
Is this out of a morbid fear that you read plane crashes?
I don't think it's a fear. I fly a lot, and you know, I guess I think about my plane crashing as much as the next person, but it's not like a fear that cripples me or makes me reluctant to fly. It really is just an interest, like a, and I've,
it's a hobby.
I wouldn't want to call it a hobby, but it is just a, it is a topic of great interest to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been trying to figure out why I would find plane crashes an interesting topic.
Uh-huh.
I've kind of been doing a bit of soul searching as I spend hours upon hours reading about it.
Yeah, as one might if you're reading all this material.
Yeah. So I think
what is your conclusion?
I think for me, plane crashes are sort of a confluence or a perfect storm of topics and issues that really appeal to my brain. Some of those are technology,
because
there's always a great deal of technology involved in a plane crash, for, whether it's for better or worse. Human drama. So because obviously the incident itself is dramatic and there are a number of humans trying to deal with it usually, but also there's a unfortunately, a great number of people are usually affected just sitting in the back, and they all in turn have their own stories and human dramas. And while it's really terrible, I think, you know, as a human, I take a great interest in the stories of other humans and what happens to them, for better or worse. There's real extremes. Like, we have, you know, extremes of speed and altitude and power and forces involved, which sort of appeal to my engineering-y mechanical brain. There's great, sometimes there's great folly, and I think that's something that always appeals to me, you know, great, you know, mishaps or, you know, hubris going wrong sometimes. I think flight is still something that fascinates us. You know, humans still will look up at a plane going overhead, although we've had them for many years. They still amaze us, and that can go wrong in such a spectacular way is hard. It's hard to ignore. Well, it's hard to ignore for me. I think there's lots of things about plane crashes that really appeal to my brain, and I wish they wouldn't happen, and I think they're terrible, but they do interest me a lot, and it just reminds, you know, with what's happened just recently with this missing airliner, it's reminded me again that it interests me, and I just thought it was something I'd put out there, because, you know, you've put a bit of yourself out there from time to time, so I'm happy to let people know this is a strange interest of mine. I mean, I'm not the Lone Ranger, obviously. There's a whole industry in plane crash television shows, you know, on National Geographic Channel. So
is that a genre?
Oh yeah, Air Crash Investigation, as it's called in the UK, is actually one of my favorite programs. I've seen them all.
Now that I know that this is an interest of yours, I'm not surprised that a show called Plane Crash Investigator is your favorite show, and you've seen them all, and you probably have them all recorded.
There's a guy who narrates it, and like when I've watched it so many times, I don't watch it much anymore because I think I've seen them all. But I used to watch them all the time, and my missus used to get sick of me watching all the time. But she said that sometimes when we get on a plane together, she feels like she can hear that narrator's voice, like in her head going, you know, they got on the flight on at 9 a.m. on a seemingly calm day. And
but little did they know.
Yeah, so anyway,
That's helpful. That's helpful for your plane travel to amp up that anxiety on a day.
Exactly.
As we mentioned before, when plane travel is terrible enough, as is, it's always good to throw that in. A narrator of doom in the back of your mind.
It's not an anxiety for me, but okay. But maybe I've created an anxiety for her, unfortunately. So.
Yeah. Good job. Good job.
Sorry about that. Anyway. You have no interest in plane crashes?
I mean, I guess I'm interested in avoiding them. that would be my primary interest in plane crashes. I can't say that I have ever read anything about them in particular. I mean, I think maybe like many other people, when the plane for a brief moment drops in altitude and you get that feeling in your stomach, I definitely think, well, I guess I'm going to die now, right, for a split second. But that might be the beginning and the end of my interest in plane crashes, is just hoping that they don't happen to me. And also, dear internet, before you write in about the statistics, I'm fully aware that plane travel is incredibly safe. My mom is a flight attendant. I have flown lots in my life. So I'm the logical part of my brain is not afraid of flying. But if you lose altitude in a plane for a split second, I do think, well, I guess that's the end of my existence.
I'll give you two nuggets from things. One thing that I just learned recently and one that's an old one, but they're two of my favorite stories about plane crashes. And it may give you some insight into the kind of trivia that makes them appeal to me. One was quite a famous incident. It was a Swissair flight and the plane caught fire above the cockpit while they were in the air. There's nothing worse than a fire on a plane. And unfortunately, it resulted in the plane crashing into the sea off Nova Scotia, I think. And everyone died. It was, you know, it was terrible, terrible thing, terrible. But one thing I just found out recently that was very interesting is that on the plane was a very famous Picasso painting. And they only recovered a tiny shred of it afterwards. But you never think about the cargo on a plane. And another thing that was on that plane, they recovered a lot of the wreckage from the bottom of the sea. One of the things they didn't recover was a whole bunch of, I think, diamonds and gems. There was like an unusually large stash of diamonds on the plane and went down with it as well. And they didn't find it. And you talk about those little, you know, there's a million stories in it. I love stories, I guess, you know, that's my nature. And a plane crash has a million stories in one event. And that appeals to me.
All ending in doom.
Well, not always. And here's my second story. There was another plane crash. I can't remember the details, unfortunately. I used to know it quite well. But it crashed. People did die. But not everyone died. And one of the people who didn't die was the co-pilot. And just as the plane was about to crash and it looked like he was going to die, the last thing he did, knowing that his voice was being recorded on the voice recorder, was tell his wife that he loved her. He said, Laura, I can't remember her name, it might have been Laura. Laura, I love you. He said it to the voice recorder. Last thing that was said, and then bang, the plane hit the ground. He ended up surviving. How many brownie points do you think he got?
I imagine quite a lot, yeah.
That's pretty good. Like you don't have to just say, you know, my last thoughts are of you. He has like proof.
He has the proof.
Yeah.
That is a good story for the person who survived. You know, and I was just thinking as you're telling me about your interest in plane crashes. So at this point, we have had I don't know the exact stats, but we have had several hundred thousand downloads of these podcast episodes, which is quite a lot. And I was thinking, given the numbers of people who are listening right now, people on the internet who hear my voice at this very moment, there is a non-zero chance that there is someone who is listening to this in the waiting area of an airplane, in the waiting area of an airport.
Or on an airplane.
Yeah, or they're on an airplane, that's true, or they're about to get on an airplane. So you've given them a little gift of extra anxiety there, Brady. That's from you to the listeners in airports right now. I hope I'm not freaking you out if you're hearing me and you actually are the listener in an airport. Tim.
Can I also just add that there's also a non-zero chance that people listening to this have lost loved ones to a plane crash. And in fact, I know someone who had died in an aviation accident. And I just want to say one final time that while I have an interest in the topic, I guess there are people who take an interest in wars and the military. I also think plane crashes are very serious, and you know, I don't want people to think I'm taking some gleeful interest in the misfortune. I think it is just a technical and human interest thing for me. And if anyone has had that happen to them, please know that I can relate to it because I've had a similar thing happen. So
I think people understand that, and that goes for whenever we talk about any topic that actually touches on the unfortunately near infinite realm of potential human misery. You know, it's like, there's always gallows humor, and that is a way that humans sometimes deal with this kind of thing.
Indeed.
I will just have a final note for you and for the listeners. If there are people who share Brady's obsession with airplane crashes, I have been listening. There's a new podcast that's on my Rota, and I'm just going to recommend it now. It's a podcast called Pragmatic. It's run by two guys called John and Ben. And one of them is, he's an engineer of some sort in Australia, and they do episodes where they talk about various engineering related things for the most part. But they recently did an episode that I listened to. I'll link it in the show notes, called Cause and Effect, where they were talking about analysis of failure. And so what do engineers and safety experts actually do after failure events in any kind of thing, right? Industrial power plants. They mentioned airplanes in particular for a reasonable section of the show. And I have found the show interesting to hear what the insights from a real professional in the field talking about engineering topics. And so this one about failure analysis was very interesting, and they have a big section about airlines. So I will put that in the show notes for listeners to potentially go check out, and for you, Brady, to go potentially check
you've
out.
You've sold me on it, definitely.
All right, I'll put it in the notes there.
We've been going an hour. Maybe we should have a topic.
I don't know. Sooner or later, it's going to be nothing but feedback, right? As assuming that this goes on for a while, as a function of time, the percent of feedback grows, right? Because eventually everything trends towards feedback. But not today yet, but we're getting close there, I guess.
Languages.
Yes.
Let me tell you a story.
Yes.
I changed schools partway through high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved to a new school where French was taught as the language that everyone had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And all my fellow students had been doing it for about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never, ever encountered a single word of French. I knew nothing. And on my first day in class, I was called upon to read from the book first, you know, to sort of gauge what I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first thing I had to say, I had to read was... I can't remember if it was je m'appelle. I think it might have been je suis, and I think I said Jesus or something like that. And I was laughed at terribly by all the other students, and I was told, you know, that's how far behind I was. That's how little I knew.
I'm sorry.
So I was behind, and I never caught up. And I was quite a good student. I got quite decent marks, and I found school quite easy. But languages, in particular French, I never got there. It was a real Achilles heel, and it remains so to this day. I am very bad at picking up any aspects of a foreign language when I need to. Mm-hmm. So I'll be very interested to hear your thoughts on language.
The reason that this is a topic that I thought is worth talking about is in one of my videos, and I'm not actually even sure which one it was. I think it was one of the Q&A ones. I made an offhanded reference to getting rid of foreign language classes in schools. It wasn't the focus of the video. It was just something that happened to be mentioned in the video.
Mm.
And I think there is nothing that I have ever said in, like, if you take the ratio of feedback divided by the amount of time I spent talking about something, nothing beats this comment about ditching the foreign language requirements in schools. I still get emails and angry tweets about this all the time from people who are coming across, as I said, I think it's a Q&A video. They come across that thing and just bam, right? Out goes an angry email with random caps in some of the sentences, perhaps, telling me just everything about how wrong I possibly am and how terrible of a person I am and how much of a culture crushing Anglophile I am. And so I thought, I've always been meaning to do a video about this, but I know this is one of those topics. I'll never make this into a proper reply video like I always want to. So maybe this is just the time to talk about it a little bit. So that is the background.
Well, I'm not surprised. Tell me your position.
Yeah. So the way it came up is I definitely now know it was one of the question and answer videos, because the way it came up is someone was asking, since I was a teacher, what would I want to add to the school curriculum that wasn't already there?
Yeah.
And my answer, for a lot of reasons, and people have seen me talk about this a lot, is computer programming. If I have to pick something, to me, this is just the no-brainer, right, that there should be much, much more computer programming in high schools than there currently is, which is basically none, you know, for all intents and purposes, especially here in the UK. I know they've added a tiny bit, but it's still so little, really. But now, as having been a teacher, I've been on the other side of this, where there's always a lot of pressures on schools to include more things. Yeah. You know, there's always initiatives, you know, or government changes, right? Things that want to be added to the school schedule. But as a teacher, you know, something has to be taken out, and so that's why I thought the interesting question is: okay, it's too easy for me to just say, well, kids should teach more computer programming languages.
Yeah.
The tricky thing is, well, what would you take out? And for me, the answer is, I look across the school curriculum, and foreign languages are just this big, juicy, slow-moving target of just such like a criminal waste of students' time as required classes, that I would just ditch it without any hesitation.
Before I ask you to expand on that,
it is
funny that you say that, though, because I mean, I spend a lot of time talking with people who are advocates of coding and computer programming.
Yeah.
And one of the things they point out that is quite helpful to develop your skills as a programmer is a good understanding of languages, including foreign languages.
Okay. All right. Let's just,
because it teaches you about syntax and, you know, things like grammar and things like that. And
yeah. Now, yeah. First of all, here's the position that I'm taking on this, right? I'm not completely against foreign languages. So in my own schooling, this is back in New York, back in the day, when I was in middle school, which I don't know exactly what grades, I can never remember what grades that corresponds to here in the UK. But anyway, in middle school, we did what was called a language survey class, where one year we did, I think it was 5 or 6 different languages. So you do each language for a couple of months. And the purpose of that was to introduce you to all the languages, and then you get to select which language you're going to be chained to for the next 5 years.
Right.
But like, here, kids, why don't you, you know, we'll do this exploration, this fun thing, and then, you know, off to the salt mines you go to learn how to conjugate verbs. And so I remember that survey class quite well, because as a kid, it was definitely a, like, you know, mind blown kind of experience. You know, what do you mean verbs and adjectives don't have to go in this order? I don't even understand. And I can honestly say that, you know, I never understood grammar until I was introduced to foreign languages, because it was just, you know, it's like the old, like the fish in the sea kind of thing, right? The fish can hardly know what the water is because they're just surrounded by it. And so I genuinely think a little bit of introduction to foreign languages is hugely helpful, to be able to, oh, I get it. This is what an adverb is. Or, you know, this is why infinitives are sort of strange in English, but they make more sense in Spanish. Like, I think that that's really good. But I don't think you need, you know, depending on where you are in school, 4 or 5 years of a foreign language to get the benefit of that. I honestly think a 1-year survey course or a 2-year survey course is like way more than adequate to get a lot of the benefits that people are often talking about with, you know, realizing and understanding your own syntax and possibly for the same kind of thing with computer programming, right? Understanding the notion of how to express thoughts in a way that is not your native way. You know, I think
you're assuming here that the reason to learn another language is to give you a greater appreciation of your own language or computer programming. But surely the point of teaching people another language is so that they can learn the other language.
Yeah, but obviously that's just a total failure, right? I mean, I just think I was a teacher, and at one school in particular, the languages were so much. The kids were required, Brady, to learn Latin and 2 other languages. So they had to do 3 languages.
Yeah.
And usually what had ended up happening is almost, this was a girls' school, almost all of the girls were doing Latin, German, and French.
Yeah.
Now, why don't you ask me how many of those kids could speak Latin, German, or French at any kind of competent level? Right? And the answer was none of them. Right, none of them could do even the most basic kind of conversations, even at the end of their experience. Right, so
Yeah, but they had to learn physics from you too. How many of them do you think still do physics?
Oh, all right. So, well, we'll talk about teaching someday, right? But you know, this is, kids used to ask me. They'd go, "Oh, you know what? You know, when am I ever going to use physics?" And my answer was always, "Never. You're never going to use this."
But there is a benefit to learning it for a long time.
Right now, here, right. So this is we have to prioritize things.
Yeah.
I completely acknowledge that the kids that I spent. I guess it depends on how the curriculum goes. But let's say I spent the same amount of time teaching kids physics as they spent learning French or Latin. I completely agree that the maybe the comprehension at the end of that is comparable, right? That you ask any of my students 2 years later how much physics they remember, and it's going to be pretty dismal.
Yeah.
So it can't just be an argument about utility, and this gets very quickly into, again, another topic of conversation. This starts to really mess up my mind, because when you start thinking about this, the same kind of thing is applicable across all subjects, right? Students learn and retain very little from school.
Yeah.
And so if you're a teacher, you know, at you can be, you know, in your dark moments at 3 a.m, you know, when it's just you and your thoughts and the bleakness of your existence, right? You start thinking, what is school even for? Right? What is this thing that we're all doing? Why are we all here? They're not going to remember anything. You know, so like you can get into existential questions about what is the purpose of school very, very quickly. And I can say there is some value in school exposing kids to a variety of different things. And some of them will be interested in some things and some of them will be interested in others.
Yeah.
Right? So one of the benefits of a science class, and I will agree with you, I think particularly in the UK, there might be physics for too long. It's very different.
I'm not saying we do physics. There's nothing to agree with here. I'm just putting it out there, man.
Yeah. I guess I'm trying to lay this out, right? Okay, so there. But if you're teaching sciences or math or economics in school, or I'm hesitant to include this, but I'll include like literature, but I think it's a little different. I think that there are lots of benefits that can come out of that, right? You don't necessarily need a lot of people to go on to become scientists, because those scientists have a disproportionate impact on society as a whole. So there is benefit to exposing kids to science. Now, I look at the language side of this, and I think, what is the potential benefit of forcing basically all of the child population of a country to learning a foreign language for years and years? And you know, we talked about systems last time. I look at that and I think, man, your return on investment on this is just terrible. It's a terrible return on investment, because the kids are not going to – they're not going to learn the language. And for kids who like the language, it's not like getting a mathematician or an engineer. Like even like the broad impact of that particular student is not necessarily very high. So for people who like languages, I'm very much in favor of languages existing as electives. If you want to take a language class, I am not here saying, no, you can't take that class. I just think it should not be required in the slightest. And in particular, and I think this is what got some people mad because I mentioned it in the video, I honestly think that teaching languages is going to be very rapidly just a totally useless skill, because natural language processing and computer translation of languages is getting very good very fast. And so I'm thinking, like, if I was in charge of a school and I was trying to pick subjects that would maximize potential future productivity for the students in my school, languages would be at the absolute bottom of the list, because I'd be doing the calculation of like, okay, well, these kids are coming in. If it's the British system, you know, they're 11 years old when they start. They're going to leave when they're 16 or 18. in that 5 or 8 year period of time, starting from today, the amount of progress that's made in translation technology is going to be, I think, bigger than people estimate.
Yeah, but we've got Wolfram Alpha now, but we don't stop teaching math.
Yeah, that's true. But I think this is one of the reasons why I actually quite liked teaching physics, because I was always able to just tell the kids, like, look, just use your calculators. You know, I don't want you to do this long division by hand, right? That's not a good use of your monkey brain, right, to be sitting there and writing down 100 numbers and trying to figure out the long division by hand.
But you need to know what's happening underneath the calculator, don't you? And is it not a bit the same with languages?
Well, okay.
Sure, I can have everything translated, but I'm not really, you know. Are we starting to erode a foundation here?
I don't understand a foundation of what, because languages are largely a communications protocol. Like when do languages come up?
You're trying. I said it once. I'll say it again. You're a robot.
An average person is going to run into a linguistical problem way more frequently in their life than they're going to run into a physics problem. You don't go on holiday and someone won't rent you a room at a hotel until you explain the Higgs boson to them, right? Like, this is not going to happen. Yeah. You know, but maybe you're stranded somewhere and you don't speak Portuguese, right?
Yeah.
So like that situation is going to be way more frequent. But you can already communicate with that person without speaking their language at all. And I was actually, when I moved to London, this is years ago now. I shared a flat with a few people, and one of them was this French girl, and she basically spoke no English, but she was renting a room, and you still have to communicate with someone about splitting the rent or the bills or the chores and all this kind of stuff. And we did it, I mean, this has got to be now 8 years ago, entirely through Google Translate. Right. You know, she didn't speak a word of English. I didn't speak a word of French, but we were able to get the basics across, you know, enough that you could actually like coexist with this person who doesn't speak the language.
Just sitting at a computer together and writing things into the fields.
Yeah, that is exactly what we did. Right. We just took turns. You know, she would type in the French spot. I would type in the English spot, and Google Translate did it. So
did you ever like wonder if you were like saying, can you please, you know, pay for half the electric bill, and Translate got it wrong and you just propositioned her?
Well, one of the things you did realize, or one of the things I realized very quickly, at least with the technology at the time, and I assume it's similar-ish, was that you learn to make the sentences nice and smooth, right? Nice and clear. You know, not a lot of, you know, something, something, comma, tangent, comma, back to the main thing. You know, because then, she would just look, and obviously the translation just went haywire and she didn't understand at all what I was trying to say. But so I look at that as well, and you know, sorry, language teachers, but I view that whole field as potentially replaceable by technology in a shorter time period than people are imagining, and so the very like even the idea of like forcing kids to learn for 5 years how to speak another language, I think that's just a huge. It's a huge waste. You know, there's way better things that you could do with student time than that. And I'm not here saying that, oh, you should fill all that time with physics. Like, I have huge problems with the way science is taught, and I have huge problems with the education system in general. So this is not meant to be a championing for the rest of it. You know, I think it's all pretty terrible. But I think that the language part of it is just the most futile that there can possibly be.
Okay.
Can I?
Well, let me respond.
Yes, I'm sorry. Go.
It is hard for me to mount a case against what you're saying for several reasons. One being that, you know, I was so bad at languages and I came out of my – I may have only done it for a year, but I came out of, you know, learning French, not being able to speak French.
Mm.
And the case you make for reducing the time, suddenly it becomes a case of, you know, then we're sort of tweaking dials and I don't know how long's too long. And I haven't experienced 5 years of one language. Mm-hmm. You know, you certainly make it sound excessive and make a strong case. But when I think back to school, you know, I'd never been out of my country before, probably like a lot of students in countries like Australia and the United States. There was nothing in my school experience that gave me a better idea and a better feeling for the scale and the differences of the world that I live in than those lessons. Even when it was just learning to say, je m'appelle Brady, tu t'appelles comment, or whatever. Like, even if it was just doing that, it kind of, it broadened me in a funny way. You know, I'd never been outside Australia, and it made me realize that there was this bigger world I was living in. And I know this is a bit wishy-washy, and it might not appeal to you. But even now, you know, now that I travel to all these countries, that time learning French somehow still is within me, and it sticks with me, and it comes back to me quite a lot. And I think it instilled in me, not like a sense of adventure and I need to travel, but a sense that there was a bigger world I was living in than this little city I was living in Australia. Mm. And there's very little in school, you know, learning the history of World War One, or learning that, you know, Albert Einstein was German. Mm-hmm. These things don't do that. They don't give you that sense of that you live in something big and mysterious the way that actually sitting there and having to learn to speak the funny language these people speak does. And I think, I don't know. I don't know what you think about that, but you certainly haven't mentioned it.
Well, okay, there's a few things about that. First of all, you got this appreciation in a much shorter time than that most students actually spend learning the lessons.
Fair enough.
And that's why I think, like, the survey course that I was mentioning before seems to me a reasonable amount of time, 1 year, maybe two. And I often see this about this appreciation for foreign cultures. And I having seen a lot of students, obviously I haven't taught languages, but my estimation of it is that there are certain kids who are going to kind of naturally develop an appreciation for the other and for the different.
Yeah.
And something in their life is going to trigger that at some point. And, you know, maybe it happens to be the language classes, but if it wasn't the language classes, it would be something else, you know, making them realize, like, oh, there's this big wide world out there. And lots of students are just totally uninterested. And this is going to sound just almost unbelievable, but I remember when I was younger doing the first couple, maybe miserable years of the Spanish language. I remember in my brain feeling like this was some kind of bizarro, arbitrary exercise of just translating all of these English words into this other language for just no reason that I could possibly appreciate.
But that's how a whole bunch of other people feel about mathematics and science. Like, I think that's what you're not realizing. I think languages can trigger your imagination and can trigger your wonder of the world the same way that physics and maths can trigger your wonder of the universe. And it's not going to trigger it for everyone. Just like I see a whole bunch of people who love science and it makes them love the universe and think language is a waste of time. There's another group who love languages and but completely feel that cold way about science and mathematics, and it's just doing stuff by rote. And I think that's the people that you've upset with your video. You've just brushed aside half the people without brushing aside the maths and sciences. So you've kind of you've taken a side in a way, and that's who you've upset.
Yeah, I guess. But I think the part of this is quickly rolling into a bigger discussion about education in general. But I feel the same way about the way sciences are taught, that it is just a total waste for almost everybody who is there.
But you're not making a video advocating throwing it away the way you did about languages.
Yes, but that is because I think that languages are – If we're ranking them in, like, stuff that just needs to change, from my perspective, the language is just the worst example of what school is. You know, for the vast majority of students, it is just endless rote that will probably be replaced by machines very shortly. You know, no skill acquisition at the end, and no real chance for a huge societal upside. Right? Like, computer programming, even if the vast majority of students don't ever do anything with computer programming, it's almost like from a government's perspective, like every kid who does computer programming is a literal lottery ticket, and you only need a couple of them to pay off, you know, before you get, you know, a Google, before you get an Apple. But you're never going to get that kind of benefit from language classes. That's just not going to happen.
I can't agree that having a generation steeped in a better understanding of other cultures and other languages, because sometimes language and culture is a bit integrated. I can't agree that having a generation steeped in that does not have a societal impact, especially in a world that's becoming more and more integrated, and we're spending more and more time with people who speak other languages and live in other cultures. I think what I just said. surely a bunch of people who have a great understanding of people from other nations, that has a societal impact. When, you know, when occasionally we see ourselves on the brink of wars, or business deals are being done worth huge amounts with people from other cultures, I think you're dismissing a lot of the stuff that goes hand in hand with learning languages and the benefits of those things.
Okay.
At least I think that argument could be made.
Yeah. Two points here. The first, remind me to come back to the business thing in case I forget.
Okay.
But the first is, I agree that there is a big benefit from having students have an appreciation of other cultures.
Yeah.
I am not against that.
Yeah.
But again, if I'm in charge of a school, I do not think that language instruction is the best way to have students actually get appreciation of other classes, right? Like I would start with that as the goal and say, okay, look, we have 4 years of extra time.
Yeah.
What can we do in 4 years that can genuinely increase cross-cultural appreciation instead of just teaching languages?
But that's not what you said, or at least that's not what people heard you say. They heard you say, let's fill that time with coding.
Well, yes, right? This is what I, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm
sort of sympathizing with you there.
No. You're completely correct. But this is the argument that I usually hear is cross-cultural promotion is good. I agree with that. I think there are better ways to do it.
Okay.
And here is my completely unrealistic ideal scenario,
yeah,
would be, say, okay, look, we have some amount of human effort and money that is spent to educate kids in Latin for 4 years, right? instead of doing that for 4 years, let's concentrate this into 6 months, right? And try to do some kind of student exchange program very intensely in a 6 month period of time. Now, I understand that on a nationwide level, that is not very practical. I'm kind of imagining a solution that an individual school might be able to do. And I think a situation where if you could just basically ship some of your students off to an actual foreign country for a limited period of time, for 6 months, and just say, you know, look, here we go. Here's a box. It's labeled ship to Rovaniemi. Off you go. And, you know, good luck with that. There's going to be nobody there who is from your culture. That would be like a transformative experience that would be so much more valuable than sitting in
a classes. Not particularly cheap one, but yeah.
Yeah. This is why I don't think it is remotely practical on a nationwide level to do that kind of exchange. But I can... And honestly, I haven't thought about this too much, but I can imagine a similar scenario where you try to do something more remotely, like having students interact, you know, through Skype or something like it with students in other places. I can see that as being more beneficial for trying to foster that kind of sense of the world than a language class. I just think if your goal is cultural appreciation, I think language teaching is the bad way to go about it. I think that's just a defense of language teaching. And if cultural appreciation is what you want, I think there are better ways to do that.
Well, I don't know. I certainly have a lot of friends that wish they could have had all their maths and physics and chemistry education condensed to a six-month taster and then a foreign holiday. But
we can talk about this at some time. But my dream... Again, another impractical dream I once tried to write out a course for this when I was a crazy younger teacher, but my dream for the sciences would be to actually have like a two-stream system in the sciences, and to have a course that's basically science for non-scientists, you know, for people who are not intending to do this as a career or related to this as a career. I think if it's the same kind of thing, like the argument that is given for teaching science a lot is this. Oh, God, I heard it so much, right? We need citizens who are scientifically engaged because it's a complicated world and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And I felt the same way that, look, if that's your goal, teaching straight up physics is a terrible way to do that. Right? There's a, if your goal is to have scientifically literate students who are not professionals in this area, you could design a much better course to achieve that as the end. You know, but making kids do F equals MA calculations all day, that's not producing scientifically literate people in the way that you're claiming that you actually want. So that's part of my frustration. I will say in defense of one thing here, which is that, again, if I was in charge of a school, there is one language that I would require. Can you, if you were going to make any guess, it's not a computer language. This is not really like a trick question, but I would require maybe, you know, 6 months or a year of training in a foreign language. Would you be able to take a guess what I would pick?
Is it the language of love? No, I am guessing that you are going to say Mandarin.
Good guess. But I would actually mandate a 6 month sign language course. That's what I would pick if I was in charge of a school. Again, I'm getting rid of 4 years of junk and I'm trying to pick more interesting things to do.
Yeah.
And I mention this because I'm not sure if we've ever discussed this, but my wife and I for a year basically kind of taught ourselves a little bit of American Sign Language. And this was a byproduct of basically I had some terrible schedules as a teacher where I was talking all day and I could not talk in the evening because my throat was just gone. And I was legitimately concerned about losing my voice over the long term. This is a kind of professional issue for some teachers where I had like a sharp pain in my throat. And so I was thinking, you know, you shouldn't really be talking if you feel that. And so we were just doing it as a kind of couple activity, you know, just something interesting to do. And
would you then do it? Would you come home with a sore throat and speak sign language to your wife?
So let's be clear here first. This was years ago. So please do not try to speak sign language to me if you speak American Sign Language. My level was never above that of like a very, very poor toddler. But my wife and I did learn the sign language alphabet, and we learned a bunch of basic signs so you could communicate some simple stuff. And I have to say, doing that was an amazingly interesting experience. And I have never felt like my brain was being more rewired than when we were doing this. And the example that I'll give, which we laughed about sometimes because it was so ridiculous, we both felt the same way, was learning the fingerspelling alphabet. So there's a hand gesture for each letter of the alphabet. I'm doing this once when my wife also had a sore throat, so it wasn't a bad situation. But so we're trying to practice by spelling words at each other and guessing what the words were. And it was this very clear feeling that the part of your brain that is used to reading is just not connected to the same part of your brain that is used to looking at humans. And so also just for nerds in the audience, people who watch my videos very closely also know this. I did in high school teach myself a little bit of Esperanto, which was a foreign language that I really did enjoy learning because I hated Spanish. And I had no interest in it, but Esperanto was very cool. So I had like learned how to read stuff in another language, but the sign language stuff was just, it was mind blowing. So like my wife would be doing in the hand symbol, she's doing, you know, D-O-G. And I would be sitting there looking at her going, dog, dog. Oh, right. Dog. Right. And then it'd be the same thing. Like, you know, B-U-S. And like, bus. Right. It was amazing. It was just so clear that some part of my brain was
sounds
not
sounds like
connected.
You and your wife have some scintillating conversations.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
It was, but
it was so interesting, and I think that's one of those experiences people talk about. You know, learning a foreign language is a different kind of learning experience, and in my own personal experience, the sign language thing felt like that, just compressed and times 1,000. And plus, I kind of want to do a video about this. I'm not sure that I ever will. But sign language, if you just know a couple things, it's so freaking useful. I cannot tell you the number of times I wish that other people knew the sign language gesture for thank you, right? Because like if I'm sort of, you know, there's a number of situations where your attention is distracted by something, but you just want to like acknowledge another person who's done something nice for you. If you could just do that as a gesture and people could know, I think that would be great.
This is another step towards your dream of not having to actually talk to other humans.
No, but it's genuinely, I think that just a couple of things. If you could know yes, no, please, thank you. I'm not asking for a lot, you know, but if every person in the world knew the sign language gestures for that, I think that that is genuinely beneficial because it's an additional way to acknowledge somebody.
It is one of the most often used terms for which there is no nonverbal communication, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It's.
But maybe that's the point of thank you, is that you have to make an effort to give it. If you could do an easy thank you, it wouldn't be much of a thank you, would it?
Yeah, but if someone is across the room, for example, and you notice that they have done something nice and they're looking at you, right? Like, what are you going to yell thank you across a busy room?
You give
at
them
a person?
Thumbs up, or you can give them just a knowing nod or one of your charming smiles.
Yeah, I don't know. I think
it's a good point. It's a good point.
I think the sign language thing is useful, and that is where if I'm in charge of school, I'm designing my ideal curriculum from scratch. You know, after shipping kids off to Finland, you know, for 6 months, bring them back. You know, then I would do a little course in sign language, and say that whole thing took a year. I think that's both of those things combined are a way better experience than you're ever going to get. Both in terms of cultural understanding and the benefits of learning about another language than from doing, you know, 6 years of French. The number keeps going up as I talk about it more. It's really 5 years.
I know, as usual, we won't have done justice to the argument you were trying to make, but that's what follow-up for was next week.
I'm already feeling terrible about it. The only final thing I would mention, two things, is this argument that I'm making, when I got into some discussions about it on the internet in the first place, I was always trying to clarify to people that if I was in charge of a school in a non-English speaking country, I would have English as a foreign language. That I would not be making the same argument that if I was in charge of a school in Italy, I would want English as a foreign language classes to be a requirement. And this just made people even angrier.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
You know, that was like the worst. I thought I was being all reasonable here. Like, oh, let me clarify my position. And like, you've clarified me into greater anger.
Yeah, you want everyone in the world to speak your language, you'd be on your time zone.
Yeah, and the thing was, I didn't, you know, this is of course the problem of being a native English language speaker. And I often wish that I had just grown up being able to speak another language. But, you know, that is not my lot in life. But if you are an English language speaker, there is very little return on investment in most cases in learning another foreign language. You know, it's very hard to ever do. And I know that in my adult life, I have made a couple of attempts to try to do that, you know, and it's been very unsuccessful. I actually have a list of things. Just I have a to-do list. I have a not-to-do list. And the top of my not-to-do list is learn another language. Because every once in a while I get this into my brain. I'm like, you know what? You should really learn another language. And I like look at the piece of paper which says, you know, you should really not do this. You have tried many times and failed, and you've written it on this little piece of paper to remind you this is on your not-to-do list. But I do think that, you know, like it or not, learning English is beneficial if you don't have English as your native language. And I have to say that the reason why I was thinking this as a topic is another podcast recommendation is the Freakonomics podcast. I don't know. Did you listen to that?
Is
that
I am list? Subscribed to it and I'm yet to listen to it. I'm too busy listening to all the other ones you've recommended to me.
Okay. Well, they just did an episode that was actually about language learning. And of course, so me, I just had this feeling that, oh, I'm sure learning English is great in a way that is not necessarily the reverse for native English language speakers to learn another language. And that was basically the conclusion of their show as well. And I felt slightly vindicated by that, was looking, they were doing a very utilitarian measure of it, but they were looking at the effect of foreign language learning on the individual's income. You know, how does this actually affect it? And the bottom line was that if you are a native English speaker, learning an additional language has a trivial effect on your average salary when you look across a population. It was something like $200 or $300 on average a year increase in salary. It was negligible.
But, well, if money is your only metric for success in life, then I heartily agree.
Yes. And then, of course, the reverse was the case with non-English native speakers. It was a substantial number. You know, I think it was a couple thousand dollars a year was kind of the immediate financial benefit from learning English. So, yeah, just from a financial perspective, it was kind of backing up the if you do not speak English as a native speaker, you probably might want to learn this. Although the interesting thing, which did not occur to me, and this is where Freakonomics is interestingly counterintuitive sometimes, they did mention that if you're going to learn a language, if you are a native English speaker and you're going to learn a language and your goal is to maximize income in the future, you want to pick an infrequently spoken language, which would not have occurred to me, but kind of makes sense in reverse, right? That if you can learn a language that is spoken much less frequently, that is much more valuable. Because again, like thinking about it, oh yeah, of course, businesses, they're probably in America not short on English and Spanish speakers. You know, that's probably not hard to find. But if you're going for a rarer language, Norwegian and English is probably much harder to find. And then consequently is much more valuable. So I thought that was interesting, a little comment from their podcast.
Indeed.
And there was an economist who has this little quote, which I think I'll finish off this little section with, because I thought it was so great I had to pause the podcast and write it down. So this was an economist who studies languages as a profession. And his comment was, if people are going to get some basic career benefit out of learning languages or it enriches their personal life, then foreign language study is great. But if it's a language that doesn't really help their career or they're not going to use it and they're not happy when they're in the classes, I don't really see the point. Teaching languages seems cruel to me. I thought that was a good little wrapping up there.
So, yeah, I just got an email.
Yeah.
From Viheart.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, she's saying, do I want to go and hang out with her and a few friends for Pi Day?
Oh, do you think envious.
But do you think she'll be upset if she finds out that what we've been talking about?
We said nice things about her video. I liked your video.
We did. We did say nice things about her video.
I am really sad that I don't get to be there with you and Viheart.
Well, but we might come to blows, you see, because I'm not going to be able to resist telling her that I think Pi is still lovely and should be celebrated, but... There's been another criticism of our podcast.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That it ends too abruptly.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to mention this.